May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio podcast. I'm DC, Pupa of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunyu Suzuki and those whose paths cross his. And anything else that comes to mind. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free from economic hardship, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. So today we have a guest, Dennis White, who was a student of Shunyu Suzuki and a fellow student at Tassajara, and he's going to pretty much fill you in on anything I would say in an introduction. So after we've had our pause to meditate, I'll just give him a call, all right? So when you hear the bell, if you're of such a mind, hit pause and meditate or whatever for as long as you want. And when you're ready to come back, hit unpause, and we'll be there to hit the bell to end the meditation or whatever, and give Dennis White a call.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Dennis.
Hi, David. How are you?
All right. How are you? That's great. That's great.
I'm not doing bad. You're in Bali?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's really clear.
Huh. Yeah. Well, it's Skype to phone. Yeah, it just depends on the day. Well, Dennis, wow, it's been a while. I think the last time I saw you, was it in Crestone?
Yeah, it was over at Paul Shippey's house.
Right, right. It was,
and Ken Campbell was over there, and Dan Welch, and you and me and Shippey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Ken Campbell. Oh, I was thinking Chuck Hoy. Somebody tall.
Yeah. Yeah, right. No, Chuck lives in Santa Fe, you know. I saw him last year, I guess it was. Or, you know, I talked to Chuck at least once or twice a year.
Huh. Huh. That's great.
I've stayed at his house in Santa Fe a few times, and he stayed at mine when he came up for a Sony Rinpoche weekend, actually, couple of years ago.
Mm.
And, you know, we always call each other on our birthdays and probably once again during the year or so.
Mm.
And, you know, Ken and I have been friends since 63, so we still...
Is that right?
In fact, we're playing pickleball tomorrow.
Wow. So you seem to be pretty busy these days, judging from the emails we have. What are you up to? What are you doing?
Well, I have a daughter and her husband and three grandchildren in New Orleans, and we have a big house with them that's a two-family house near City Park. We live there half the year, and then I have four grandchildren here, about to have a fifth one, and four children here in around Boulder, Colorado. So,
really?
You know, we come here about half the year. My wife works in public health clinic that she worked in them for 25 years, and she, you know, works when we come back here.
Mm.
So that's more or less what, you know, I'm doing. We actually just got back to Boulder. We've been in New Orleans the last 3 months, and just came back. We have a little house in Denver, and, you know, we go back and forth. Not every other weekend or anything, but it's probably about 50-50. One of my sons is in Denver, North Denver.
Oh.
And, most of my children are, one's in Denver and one's in Berthoud, which is near Boulder. And then, you know, one of my sons is married to Shibata Sensei's granddaughter.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah, they just had twins last year. They're 1 year old. Huh. They were 49 and 40. They'd never had children and went to an acupuncturist and lo and behold had twins.
Oh, my gosh.
Married for 15 years. And they inherited Shibata Sensei's place. And, you know, it's a big, nice housing, but a big archery range and big zendo. And she still teaches kudo, you know, on weekends and stuff.
Oh.
So,
wow.
Strong Zen connection there.
Ah, yeah, indeed. And his connection, even though he was Zen, his association in America was always with Dharmadhatu Shambhala, right?
Yeah. It definitely was. It was. Trungpa Rinpoche had asked him to teach his students, you know, back in the 70s, and he started coming back and forth and so forth. And then, Trungpa Rinpoche, Dharmadhatu, bought him this big spread, you know, out on North Broadway. And his granddaughter used to travel with him sometimes. That's where my son met him. Met her, and they wound up getting married. They've been married probably 13, 14 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They have these great twins. They're really neat. Two boys, you know.
Mm.
Couldn't be more different. That's kind of fun. I was over there yesterday feeding them and stuff like that.
Are you involved with Shambhala now?
No, not really. I'm a student of Sony Rinpoche and pretty strongly connected with that. You know, he's been doing like 3 or 4 online teachings from Nepal, you know, that they're, live online in like 27 countries or so. Been connecting with those, and they're transmitted from Crestone. Their IPT person is, lives in Crestone, and the whole setup there, and he uses a translator, although he teaches in English mostly, so he's been doing as much. We used to do a 2-week thing every year in Crestone, and hoping to do it again this year if the COVID allows it, but I don't know if it will.
You mean in 2022?
Yeah. It's sort of scheduled for the end of May, but I really don't know. I mean, he's, and rightly so, been pretty cautious. You know, usually about 165 people there, and a lot of us are pretty old. And, you know, to do that in a huge tent with, you know, it just won't work if the COVID's running wild again.
Right.
It used to be.
Right. It is continuing, huh? My.
Yeah. There doesn't seem to be any abating of it at this point.
Yeah. How has it affected your life?
Well, you know, just it's different with getting together with children and everything. You know, everything has to be pretty cautious. One of my sons, wife's pregnant, you know, and we're careful around that. And I'm just really careful. I mean, I always wear a mask when I go indoors, but it's limited social involvement a lot. You know, I mean, you have to just do it differently now than he used to. And I don't know, it used to be, we had this group here, Ken was the, and his wife Catherine, and directors of the, was Sony Rinpoche, still happening, but it doesn't meet once a month like it used to. And, you know, they're just, everything's more limited. How is it in Bali?
Well, the numbers are very, very low. There's just like, right now, I think there's an average of 3 new cases identified on average, you know, daily. Average of yesterday, I saw the last 7-day average, 0.3 deaths per day. The 79% have had at least one vaccination, and 60-something percent have had 2, and plan to get a booster, and I hope I can get it in January. They're very efficient. I'm surprised.
What booster did you get? I mean, what vaccine did you get?
Well, I got AstraZeneca, but I'm going to try to get a Moderna booster, but I don't know if that's possible. Up to now, Moderna has just been for medical workers and dentists, you know, x-ray technician. I ran into a x-ray technician, gosh, about 3 months ago, who just had his Moderna booster. I'd like to get Moderna. Pfizer, of course, would be fine, but I just assume it's harder to ship and everything, you know. So I'm not sure. But the places, it's not letting foreign tourists in. I mean, foreign tourists can get in, but it's very expensive, and there's hardly any ever. I just read there were 13,000 Indonesian tourists coming in every weekend to Bali. But so they're letting Indonesian tourists come here. But it's pretty quiet. But, I mean, compared to when there's tourists, actually, it seems pretty normal. And, you know, like, you can... Places are fairly open air. I'm going to go hear some jazz tonight and have dinner at an Italian restaurant. And it's wide open. It's actually less open than most places I would go to. But, you know, they don't have any front wall.
and it's a good thing, I think, to keep it down right now. It's like, you know, this country, it's very politicized, like everything is. So there's all these right, you know, it's mostly right wing anti-vax stuff, and you know, they're course getting it when dying more than the rest. But there's just, everything is so polarized here, it's almost like Civil War level, but yeah. I mean, it hasn't reached it, but it certainly it could reach it, actually.
There's a lot of new age health wellness community anti-vax stuff in America too that isn't right wing. You got it from, that's been very influential, I've read. Neither of my sons have been vaccinated. They will. Kelly had it really bad, and he is in excellent shape. And,
one of your sons is named Kelly?
Kelly.
K-E-L-L-Y?
Yeah. Diane Goldschlag. Diet.
One of my sons is named Kelly.
Oh, really? Oh, you don't?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, my father was Kelly.
Oh, really? Yeah. Kelly's 31. He's the one that's about to have a baby for the first time, his wife.
Ah.
In February, you know, yeah.
Ah. Kelly's 48, and Clay is 30.
Wow.
And, you know, they will get vaccinated. Well, they have to come here. They can't come here unless you're vaccinated. You can't. You can't renew a visa here unless you get vaccinated. You can get deported for having two citations without a mask. There was a guy head of the big punk band here in Bali led an anti-mask rally. It was very small. Nobody, you know, but he got 2 years in prison for that. But he recanted and they let him out.
They get rolling pretty fast when you see those doors close.
Yeah, yeah. Asia in general, I would say, I don't know any exceptions. They take it very seriously, and there's not the opposition you get in the Western countries. To me, the Western countries, the freedom and the openness are proving to be a big weakness in many ways in terms of disinformation and, you know, dealing with things like the vaccine. But, you know, we all like it.
Yeah, well, part of the problem is there's so much misinformation, and it's become, you know, people get their news from Fox News and Newsmax and these things that are just pure propaganda. They were, you know, that Trump really prepped into sort of a propaganda organ and so forth. And, you know, that's kind of what people stick to. So there's almost like two realities for people in this country in a way.
Yeah.
And it's which one you choose to believe. But the violence tends to come from the right, of course. And, you know, they're the ones that are really, you know, racist and so forth. And ironically, a lot of those people are the people that are being hurt the most by the politics of the Republican side of things. But they don't see that. And they see some kind of the news media just keeps pumping this propaganda about taking your liberties away and blah, blah, blah.
And right. And Antifa, really Antifa, they'll say all the violence is coming from Antifa. But, yeah, there's I don't know, it didn't look good. It didn't look very promising what's happening in America. I think America could turn fascist.
It really could.
Yeah.
It really could. Yeah.
That doesn't usually work out real well for countries. But we're in such critical times right now with climate change and everything. It just seems America's being pretty suicidal to me. And but, you know, it'll take everybody with it.
Well, that's what's happening. I mean, it's just so bad in so many places. I mean, Russia's crazy, China's crazy, everywhere,
yeah.
You know, things. I mean, there was, once in a while, there's a bright spot. Like Sunday, there was a election in Chile that I've really been watching and was really encouraging.
I didn't notice. I know that the Pinochet guy lost then, huh?
Yeah, he did, to that right-wing 35-year-old student.
Oh, good. That was horrible to think of a pro-Pinochet person winning in Chile after they killed, like, I don't know what, 20,000 people or something.
Yeah, well, I have some big friends in the Buddhist community that came up here from Chile. This very famous, actually, physicist named, neuroscientist named Francisco Varela. You see his work sometimes with the symposium with Dalai Lama and stuff. He and his wife Lenore, and they were ones that would have been arrested and killed, you know, if they hadn't been able to get out of Chile. They came here in the late 70s. And,
yeah.
You know, with the Pinochet thing was really awful. And really what happened the last couple of years, there have been these big student uprisings, but a lot of them turned very violent down there. And that's why they could actually do as well as they did the right wing, because a lot of people get panicked about law and order and shit like that. And then the whole thing can really lead to some kind of fascist thing, but it didn't. The guy only got about 44%, so Kast, K-A-S-T was his name.
Yeah. I mean,
but he was really bad. He was just openly wanting to go back to the good old days of Pinochet, and he was, you know, right down the line, anti-abortion, anti-gay, you know, everything, and he still came close, but he certainly didn't make it.
Wow.
And he was more gracious than Trump. He actually was pretty good when he lost about it, you know, and that's not the usual thing these days.
Yeah. Trump set a precedent there, you know, by saying, well, I actually won, you know, they stole it. And apparently that was, what's his lawyer's name? Giuliani. That was Giuliani told him to do that. And I think in Myanmar, the military picked up on that. When they lost big, they just, you know, said it was fraudulent and took over. But they might have done that anyway.
They would have done that anyway. I mean, they, you know, barely were letting things ride for the last few years anyway. You know, they had Aung San for a long time under house arrest, and then she was out, but she wasn't exactly allowed to be president. But then when she just got overwhelmingly voted in again, they just clamped down. That one's really awful.
Yeah.
But it's been that way. I was there in the 60s when it was Burma. And, you know, I was on a merchant ship before I went to Zen Center. And I went into port there. And when you got into port in Rangoon, they came on the ship and they put this, hammered this notice on the wall of the ship there, saying anybody caught ashore with firearms would be executed immediately. And, you know, I was in town that day. I was walked around and smoked a little opium and stuff. And I was talking to one of the Burmese guys. And I said, who's the president of your country, you know, or something? And he said, well, so-and-so, he's in the United States right now visiting. And then he winked at me and he said, well, but he won't be president when he comes back. And sure enough, about 3 weeks later, there was a military coup, and that was in 1966.
Yeah.
So they've had that going for a long, long time, you know, there. It's always been a kind of rough country that way. But
yeah,
this one has been one of the worst. I mean, it's just blatant. There isn't any, you know, they're not... They're just arresting, killing, torturing anybody that gets in their face this time. It's really, that one's one of the worst in the world right now. It just really makes me sad every time I think about it or rethinking about it.
Yeah. And, you know, I know people who've been in monasteries there, you know, practicing Vipassana and, and I also know people that Burma was their favorite country to go to in Asia.
Well, that's the thing. It's been a Buddhist country. Remember that, what was his name? Thayadaw. He was a Burmese monk. Trungpa Rinpoche really liked him. And I think Roshi mentioned him once too. Sarnasi Thayadaw. I cannot think of his name, but it's...
Oh, you mean Silananda?
No, it was a book, one of the early books that were around on Vipassana practice. He was Theravadin.
Oh, do you mean what the Buddha taught?
Well, I don't know. No, that wasn't it. No, this was way before him. It was Sayadaw was his last name, and he was a Burmese monk.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, really at time when he was teaching Shamatha early on, you know, he would mention him as being one of the good books that people could follow in terms of mindfulness, mindfulness of body, mindfulness of breath, mindfulness of, mm-hmm. you know, emotions and thoughts and so forth, so that approach. And he held him up as an example of a genuine teacher rather than, you know, something else, which Roshi and Rinpoche were both really, really supportive of each other as being genuine teachers. Mm-hmm. Suzuki Roshi said, Trungpa Rinpoche is my closest brother and you can trust him completely. And Trungpa Rinpoche was just, Suzuki Roshi was like the spiritual father he thought he'd never find in America, he had said.
Yeah.
That was where I met Trungpa Rinpoche when he used to come to Zen Center.
Yeah, quite an event. When did you go to Boulder? I mean, did you go straight from Zen Center to Boulder?
Yeah, what happened was, you know, I was running the child care at Zen Center for after Roshi died for a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
My wife at the time, Bonnie. And but I was connecting more and more to Trungpa Rinpoche. You know, I never really did, although I've become friends with Richard Baker, actually, because we both lived in Crestone and stuff. And but I just never connected to him as a teacher. And I was more and more connected with Trungpa Rinpoche. So one of his, when he came to San Francisco, he gave a talk at this Unitarian church. And I wrote him a letter and saying, you know, that I'd been at Zen Center for 4.5 years. And, you know, I was really had been going to his talks and I would like him to be my teacher. So after the talk that night, you used to be able to get online and come up to Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, afterwards.
Right,
say
right.
Hello or whatever. So we went up there, Bonnie and I, and we had our baby who was about 10 months at the time. My daughter Karina, and talked to him. Trungpa Rinpoche said, what are your names? And I said, Dennis and Bonnie White. He said, oh, from Zen Center? And I knew he'd gotten the letter. And I said, yeah, and I was waiting for you to tell me, you know, you need to stay there and work out your trips or whatever, you know, which is kind of what I was hearing at Zen Center sometimes. But they gave me this big hug. He says, come to Boulder. I'm welcoming you to Boulder. And he gave Bonnie a big hug and says, come to Boulder. And our daughter started crying because he kind of squeezed her, crunched her when he hugged Bonnie. And he tried to cool her out and she wouldn't stop crying. And he said, well, that's a good sign. That's a good sign. So 3 weeks later, we bought a car from Winona Ryder's mother, Cindy Palmer.
Yeah,
her?
Right.
Loring's sister. Bought this old Dodge Dart from her and just took off and drove to Boulder.
Yeah. My.
He really liked the Zen people that came. He used to make us the ones that did the Yunze, the bell ringers, and the posture correctors and everything, he said, because we had the shrine room discipline, you know. So he really usually put us right into the, you know, structure of the practice, what he was trying to do with the practice. Yeah.
He liked people from Zen Center to come there, and Suzuki Roshi liked people from Zen Center to go there. I mean, he felt he couldn't handle everybody and that it was better for some people. And it clearly was. Some people did a lot better when they went to Boulder.
The other way was happening, too. You know, Trungpa Rinpoche had sent two of his older students, Kumagawa and Fran Lewis, to Tassajara. Because that was the idea Roshi and Trungpa Rinpoche had. They were starting to send students back and forth. The Zen Center had the discipline and, you know, the openness and how to go different open of the practice in a certain way was really helpful for Zen, you know, Zen students. So they were starting to send people back and forth. And then they had started the Maitri Project together, you know, working with people with mental health. And then it just wasn't happening with Richard Baker. He just said, well, he seemed to be trying to negotiate the relationship or something. And so he said, I just decided to do this on my own and dedicate it to Suzuki Roshi. It was the thing of working with people with mental illness and so forth, which he put a bit of energy into in the early days back in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a shame. You know, he and Roshi couldn't have lived longer. It was, you know, that's all there was to it.
Yeah, too bad both of them didn't live longer.
Yeah, it's true. Roshi lived longer than Trungpa Rinpoche.
Yeah.
Years. Ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he had a different lifestyle, to say the least.
Yeah. Rather different. Yeah. Suzuki was, you know, he said, he drinks alcohol like I drink water, but that's a minor problem. Some people were, you know, shocked at Trump's behavior or whatever, but they couldn't get any support from Suzuki.
He said he was my closest brother, and you can trust him completely.
So you went to Boulder in about 74?
70, right at the end of 73.
Uh-huh. And so what did you all do there?
Well, when I first got here, I just needed to make it. You know, I didn't have any great livelihood abilities or anything. So, I think, you know, I cleaned houses for about a month or so, and I did different things. I drove a taxi cab. I drove a school bus. I started landscaping. Ken was here already. He'd left a year before me at Zen Center. And we've been friends way before Zen Center, too. And I wound up living in this kind of communal house named Marpa House that lasted for a long, long time. And, you know, big place with about 35, 40 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the one of the third director at Marpa House.
Mm.
Ken was second one, actually. And, you know, I just... I've done different things over the years. My main job, the last part of my working life, I was the senior case manager at the homeless shelter in Boulder.
Oh.
Which is a big, and I worked for hospice a bit before that. So, in later years, I got into social work, which is really the thing that really fit for me the most.
Mm.
And I've been married almost 40 years now. My wife's the medical director of these public health clinics that are in the Denver metro area, one in Boulder and so forth. And, you know, she's worked for that. So we've been kind of in the social justice world, you know, social.
But
I mean, that's the livelihood I, you know, appreciated the most.
Bonnie died, I remember. When was that?
Bonnie died about 33 years ago.
Is that right? Like that long ago?
Yeah. Because Jimmy, my son, will be 49 in a few days, and I believe Jimmy was 15, almost 16.
Uh-huh.
And I met my next teacher, actually, you know, kind of through Bonnie's death, to tell you the truth.
Mm.
You know, I studied with Kenpo Soltram Gamso Rinpoche for a lot of years. I was really close to him. And he'd come up from he lives in Nepal, but he'd come from Crestone where he was teaching to give a talk in Boulder because Jemgun Khonsu had just died, a young one of Kargi princes had gotten killed in a car accident in Nepal. And he'd come up and he'd give a talk to the Boulder Sangha, and then Bonnie was dying, actually, and she was at Ken's house. You know, she died over there. And she was a couple of months away from dying at that point. And I guess Ken's wife, Catherine, had asked, would Kenpo come over and see Bonnie, you know? So he came over, and he just marched right into her room. You know, she's laying there. He said, "Are you afraid to die? Don't be afraid." And he gave her about a half an hour of pure Dharma, and she was really pretty different after that. You know, I think that was the greatest thing, you know, that could have happened with her. She died from cancer. You know, she was just before she was 50. And we'd been divorced for a few years, but we were friends, you know. I mean, yeah. We really took care of our children mutually, and we're still in the same sangha and everything, you know, at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the region thing started to be something that was really, it just was a real split on the sangha, you know.
And right.
And I was on the Adai region side, although I had liked the region before.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, we had lost it with the power stuff. And, you know, it was kind of pretty hard in the sangha there. And it was like I got out of the sangha and really, but I didn't get out of being a Buddhist or anything. But I was sort of moving away from what was happening there. And then I met, you know, Kempo Sultan Gyaltsa Rinpoche, who taught with Bonnie there. I connected with him, and I wound up really being pretty close student of his till he had a stroke and couldn't teach her. Leave Nepal anymore. And then a little later, Ken had connected with Sony Rinpoche, and I had too, but not strongly. You know, I'd been his daily supervisor once for a day, and I'd really liked him when he was younger. But then I went to a thing with him, and that was it. I felt like this was, you know, Roshi was the bridge to Trungpa Rinpoche, who was the bridge to Sultan Gyaltsa Rinpoche, who was the bridge to Sony Rinpoche. And at this point, I'm 80 years old. I'm just in the stream. Maybe I'll get somewhere near the ocean, but it's not, Sony Rinpoche is the captain of the particular ship I'm going down river on at this point, for sure.
Yeah. Well, where did your, when did your, spiritual path begin? I mean, how far back would you put that? You know, like from there to coming to Zen Center, what's that trajectory there?
Well, it was in, 1964. I was in the paratroopers for 4 years.
No kidding.
Yeah, from 16 to 21, it was like even lied about my age and went in early. And I'd gotten out before Vietnam, and I'd become pretty anti-military, too, by my last year. So anyway, I went to college. I, you know, dropped out of school in the ninth grade, but I was going to junior college.
You did? In the ninth grade? Yeah. Where are you from, man?
Virginia originally, and then Long Beach, California.
You dropped out of school living in Long Beach?
Yeah.
In the ninth grade? That's pretty hard to do. Wow.
It was in the 10th grade. I mean, the day I turned 16, I walked, you know, it was.
Uh-huh. And did you just join the Army right away?
Pretty quickly after that, you know, I had no idea what it was about, but I thought to do with my life, so that's what I did.
Wow.
And then I got out and I went to junior college. I'd gotten married. And
where?
in Long Beach, California, down the line. And my second year there, toward the end, I met this woman who was kind of different than anybody else that I'd met. It was turned out it was she was kind of on the edge of the hippie thing. And she had been connected with this kind of commune that had started in Long Beach, you know. And I met Ken Campbell's first wife there, who they weren't married at the time. She was with this other guy, an artist named Ren Renpage. But I really connected with Carol, and we became sort of friends. And then at a certain point, she, you know, I met Ken because I went to a couple of parties with Carol. And Ken and I sort of hit it off, and he said, would you like to take peyote together? And I said, yeah, let's do that. So in finals of my second year, he and I and this other guy, this friend of his, over at this black woman's house named Ollie, who was the girlfriend of the other person, we all took peyote, and that was it. I didn't even bother to find out what my grades were for about 10 years. I wound up living in communes. I lived in the Mushroom Village in southern Mexico until I got kicked out of there for about a year. And, you know, I was hitchhiking around the country. And when Ken went to Zen Center, because his wife at the time, Pat, had gone to Zen Center and she was pregnant. So I was with this Portuguese woman, and we were on our way to this commune out in New Mexico, and I hitchhiked up to Zen Center to visit Ken, and we stayed a couple of days. But
what year was this? When was this?
This was April of 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was actually on my birthday.
Mm.
Strangely enough, he and I had the same birthday, April 19th.
And wait, and, what? What? Oh. You and who have the same birthday?
The woman I was with.
Oh, that's neat. April 19th?
Yeah.
That's my son Clay's birthday.
Really?
Yeah.
We got a son with the same birthday, and we got boys with the same name.
February, March, April. Yeah. Uh-huh. And Hitler's the 20th.
Wow.
Really? Yeah. I wanted to know, what commune were you hitchhiking to in New Mexico?
Well, it was this place, they called it Lower Farm, and it was near Placitas. And it was a heavy-duty place, actually. It was really pretty strung out and a lot of stuff. My girlfriend wound up leaving, you know, going back to Ojai, and she was supposed to come back, but she didn't. So I was living, you know, let me tell you a little bit of why I went back to Zen Center.
Oh, yeah, you know, I didn't let you tell the, I didn't realize, you haven't really told about the first time you went to Zen Center.
Well, it was just a day, and I went and I sat, you know, Kim suggested I, you know, invited me over to sit.
Yeah.
And it was in that old Sokoji temple.
Right.
Where we sat around the, yeah. And I was sitting, and I was kind of looking at everybody to see how I was supposed to hold my hands and stuff. And I don't know what I did. I had probably had my fingers crunched together. And Suzuki Roshi came by, and he stopped. And he bent down, and he started straightening my hands out, you know, to put me into a mudra. And I was so tight about it. I was trying to please him or something, and I wouldn't let him just. I couldn't just relax and let him do it. And he looked at me with this look that was kind of sarcastic in the most compassionate way. Like, I don't know, somehow the way Roshi could hold that mirror up, it was like, you're going to be kind of a tough student or something. I mean, somehow I saw my mind in that moment. And so that was it. I went on to that commune. It was 3 crazy months out there. But something really stuck with me, you know. And one day I was living out by the stream there. It was the summer, and doing horoscopes or whatever. And this doctor, this guy in a white smock comes bounding through the bushes, and he says, shaking my hand, says, I'm Dr. Plock from this, I mean, Dr. something from the Plague Commission. And one of your members has bubonic plague, and everybody's going to get shots this afternoon out in the garden. So I looked at him, and, and I went out there, and I looked, and, you know, people were lined up out in our gardens there, and they had these tables and giving these shots. And I thought, you know, I don't want to get a bubonic plague shot, and I don't want to be here either. So I went around, and I stuck my thumb out on the road. I just walked around it all, and I hitchhiked straight to L.A. It took me about a week to get to Zen Center because I stopped in Ojai. And I came in during Trudy's funeral. Trudy, what was her name? Trudy
Dixon. Trudy
Dixon. Yeah, I asked where everyone was. There was some person there. It was the old dorms there, and they said, well, they're at this funeral for this lady, Trudy Dixon, who was a very important person at Zen Center, you know. So I kind of remember the day I actually came. And I stayed in those dorms for about a month, and then the Mark Alexander and I got a place over in the Haight, and we would get up at 5 every morning and walk, you know, over to Zen Center and sit. And the building, then we got the building, and I applied to get in, and Reb said, well, you haven't been around long enough, but a month later, they let me in, you know, so I moved in about a month after the building opened, and that's how I wound up going there and so forth. So in a way, my spiritual journey started back in 64. There was always kind of that component to what I was doing, you know, psychedelics and everything. But on the other hand, you know, I didn't have any, it had run that course like I did with a lot of hippies there, and then going to Zen Center and meeting Roshi. That was the thing that just saved me, I feel like, you know, in a certain way, that gave me some ground, gave a path, you know, gave some clarity to the whole thing. Even though it was very hard for me there, it took me a long time to even be humble enough to realize Roshi was my teacher. And, you know, but on the other hand, something in me was always knew that, you know, it was like, one part of me was saying, well, I know more than this guy. I've been, you know, doing all of this stuff. Another part of me was doing exactly what he said. I hardly ever missed a sitting or anything there, you know, and did all the sessions and went to Tassajara and everything. And actually, after Tassajara, I went back to the mushroom village. I hitchhiked down there. I was planning to live there. And I went down through the jungle for about 2 days and got almost there, and I realized some things happened, and I realized, you know, I don't belong here. I'm not an Indian, and I need to go back to Zen Center. I went back, and I didn't go right away. There was the Integral Yoga Institute had asked me to be the child care director there, and I was contemplating whether to do that or not, and I decided to, you know, I really needed to go to Zen Center and just keep sitting because that's what worked. And then I met Bonnie, you know, and we wound up. And I told you the other part of the story when I left.
Right.
So that's,
well, do you have any particular memories of Suzuki Roshi?
Yes, I do. I mean, the first message, the first thing that ever, the first mirror he ever gave me was the one I mentioned, but the second one was actually before we left Sokoji. You know, we used to chant in that little Buddha hall there, and you'd stand up after sitting and do the chants, you know?
Yeah.
And this was only about a couple of weeks after I'd been back, I think, somewhere around there, and Roshi would walk up and down the aisles where you were sitting. So, you know, I was like decided, you know, I had all this energy and I'm just the greatest chanter ever. And I'm going to show everyone, you know, I was like so enamored with how powerful I was. And Roshi came by, you know, as Roshi came by, he didn't say a word. I'm not even sure he looked at me or his face changed at all. But somehow when he came by, I thought I saw his mouth turn down slightly. It was like looking in a mirror. I saw what I was doing. I was trying to be one up, you know, in the spiritual thing and overpower the situation. Uh-huh. And I went down to a whisper. Took me a couple of days before I could even chant normally again.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was a very powerful reflection and teaching. And then the other thing that really changed my life, which has been the koan for my whole life, really, in a way, was when one of our sesshins there, Loring Palmer, was a cook.
Yeah.
And Loring and I didn't get along very well anyway. That's why I don't remember. But anyway, it was right in the middle of the sesshin, and I'd been this very rigid vegetarian for about 6 years or so, you know, very obnoxious about it, too, very critical of others and very hard on myself. And Loring put fish stock in the soup.
Oh.
And we got into it in the kitchen, you know. I got on his case about it, and he said, "I'll throw your ass out of here." And I said, "Yeah, you and what army?" And just then, Reb was coming through the kitchen. This was right in the middle of the sesshin, you know. And Reb said, "Come with me." And he took me out in the hall. He says, wait out here. And he went up, and he came back down and said, "Suzuki Roshi wants to see you." So I came up, and Roshi's sitting there. You know, when you went into his room, there'll be two cushions arranged, you know, when you had a thing.
Yeah, jokes on. Yeah.
I sat up. Yeah, and I sat on the other one, and I was facing him, and I said, "Roshi, Loring put fish stock in the soup, and I haven't eaten meat or fish for 6 years, and blah, 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 blah." And I just kept talking, and Roshi's just sitting there watching me. I didn't feel any judgment. I didn't feel anything. It was just he was watching, and pretty soon my battery just wore down, you know, and we're just sitting there. And it felt like we were sitting there for a while. I know it wasn't that long, but anyway, things got really quiet, and all of a sudden Roshi spoke, and he said, "Let me tell you something." He said, "Your ideals are the death of reality." He said, "You can be 99% or even 90% perfect in this world if you like. Don't ever try to be 100% perfect because you just push the world away and have no relation to it." That just somehow totally penetrated. And then he said, we talked a little more. He said, "You know, I prefer not to eat meat too, but when I go to my friends, they offer it." And anyway, we just talked a little. And then, you know, that was it. I went back and set the sesshin. And I didn't rush out and get a cheeseburger. Actually, I was on my way to Tassajara in 2 weeks. And I stopped by that little restaurant in Carmel that I was going to walk. I walked in the Zen Center like a lot of us did into Tassajara like a lot of us did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that 6 hour walk from Carmel. And I was having my last meal before I went down the hill to Tassajara. And this guy, I stopped in this little cafe, and this guy I'd never seen before. I was sure it was Suzuki Roshi in another form, kind of tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, "Hey, you know, I ordered this chicken fried steak and I haven't touched it, but I'm not hungry. Do you want it?" And I looked at him and some kind of sanity flashed in my mind. And I said, "Yeah, I do." And I ate it, and it was like this big bag I'd been carrying on my back, you know, of you've got to be a certain way and others have to and I have to, and stuff was gone about that. And I went on into Tassajara. So I felt that was the second part of Roshi's teaching with that particular thing. And I never had to be that rigid again about that. Although, you know, that particular thing, your ideals of the death reality, you know, that's a running thing through my life, having to continually see it with my children and every people and everything. So I feel like that was the most powerful, first lesson, most powerful teaching I had from Roshi. There were, you know, there were a couple of other things that, but that was the one, I would say. And then, I don't know, I just I appreciated the, you know, the way he would come and he would stand at the door when we would leave at 5 o'clock and sitting, you know, and you would bow to him and go out. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Definitely.
And every time, you know, I would come up and try to, you know, bow a certain way or relate to him a certain way, or once in a while even try to ignore it, get by fast. And I could always feel something like he was holding up a mirror to my state of mind with that. But once in a while, once I remember really clearly, I bowed and I was walking down the hall and he turned and was watching me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, could kind of tell. And I realized what had happened. I had just bowed to him simply without any expectation or any hangover or anything and just walked off. And of course, the next time I came through, I tried to do it again. You know, and, you know, trying to do anything always just, you know, comes over the.
Right.
But anyway, it was such a, to me, it was such a mirror, that bow with Roshi every day, you know, just the way he could reflect your state of mind. And the last time I saw him was also very helpful, because I've always had a little tendency towards being a hypochondriac in a way, or something like that, you know.
Being what? Oh, really, hypochondriac. Hypochondriac. All right.
Yeah, just sort of anxious about my health. And, you know, I ran in, I'd been at work, and I just come in, and Roshi'd been real sick. It was maybe 2 months before he died, and I hadn't seen him. You know, my room was the one right next to him, but I just hadn't seen him for a while.
Right.
He was standing in the hall. I went up the stairs, and he was there. And I said, "Oh, Roshi, I haven't seen you for a while." You know, he just stopped the way he did, you know, engages you. And I said, "How are you?" And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, I've not been very well." And then he looked at me completely. I felt like he said, "But I don't worry about it." And that was the last communication we had. Then he just sort of ran off down the hall. I think he might have had some intestinal thing or something, but somehow that, just seeing the serenity, you know, of someone that was dying that way, and was a tremendous lesson to me, you know, of what it was might be possible, you know, to develop yourself spiritually like that. The other thing that was, it wasn't a personal thing, but that I really appreciated about Roshi was, I don't know if you were there for this one, but that we were having a session starting the next morning, and there was this black guy in the neighborhood that used to come over once in a while. He was kind of crazy. He thought he was a Ronin or something. I don't remember his, I only knew his first name. He never really sat with people. But
what was his first name?
I would know it if I heard it,
oh.
But I don't remember.
Oh.
But, you know, he was in the office there, and there were a few of us there, where the clock was, you know, the clock that was set, that rang for everyone to get up, you know, that over the loudspeaker.
Uh-huh.
And it must have been, we left him in the closet for a moment, in there by himself, the moment for a little while. Anyway, the next morning, you know, the gong rang to get everyone up. You know, we came down to the Zendo, and it was supposed to start at 5 o'clock, the sitting.
Yeah.
And he had set the clock back, so it was an hour.
I've never heard that part of it. Oh, that's great.
And, when we got down, everyone realized it was an hour early and went back to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And Roshi came down, and Roshi was just furious Somebody got up and he threw his Kiyosaku down the hall. He hit a couple of people walking down the aisle. And he says, "What are you? Monks or laymen?" He couldn't even get the language together. He was so angry. He threw his Kiyosaku on the floor. I still remember it clattering. He was so angry that we would get up. We would go down to sit, realize it was an hour early, and go back to bed instead of staying there and sitting. He wasn't mad at this guy at all. He was mad at us. Being that relating to practice that way. And that was a very strong message to me too, you know, that it wasn't just like a movie. You paid your fee and it started on time and everything, but you had, you know, are you genuine about, you know, wanting to practice that way? So that was a very powerful message to me that Roshi manifested there. So those are highlight things, but you know, you ask for the things that struck me the strongest.
Yeah, pretty impressive path your life has been on. You know, going from dropping out of school, the 16 paratroopers, and wow. Then you know, down in Mexico at the mushrooms and the peyote we can in Zen Center and Trungpa and the Rinpoches you've studied with.
I'm greatly fortunate, and I'm very fortunate to have 7 children and 8 grandchildren. And, you know, my wife's great. We've been married 38 years now. She's one of the more straightforward people. She's been, you know, just the stability. Really, because I've never really been that stable in a certain way, always a tendency to. But her thing is very different. It's been a really good balance in a certain way. And, you know, had great Sangha friends. You know, Ken and I have been first close friends now for 50-some years, and here I am talking to one of my old friends from the 1970 right now.
Yeah, right, years ago. Right, right.
Which is, you know, great fortune. Great fortune.
Yeah. Well, it's really been good talking with you. I've really enjoyed it. It's just been good to reconnect with you. I hope we meet again. And you know, if I went back to the States, I might make it to Colorado. I always like going there, but I don't know if I'll get back, I suppose.
Well, if you do, I would always be glad to see you. Or if you make it to New Orleans, I happen to be there, I'll be at one of the two.
I really like New Orleans. I have good friends I can stay with there. I spent some time in New Orleans when I was young, very young. Yeah.
We have a big house over by City Park. I'm pretty good friends with the director of the Zen group there. That's the only Buddhist group in the city, really.
Yeah, well, the one started by Robert. Do you know Robert, or is he still there?
No, it's this guy, John Vaughn, who is a... actually, he was just over my house recently. He was a student of Tulku Ujin, who's the father of my present teacher, Sonny Rinpoche, for about 25 years, and a strong practicing Buddhist. And Zen Center was looking to hire someone to do their ITT.
Uh-huh.
And they hired John. And then he did that for a couple of years, and he said, well, I figured as long as I was there, I might as well get into the practice. And then he wound up moving to New Orleans, so he started the Zen group there.
Oh, it's not the one that was started by the Deshimara student, Robert. I'm pretty sure his name is. I spent some time with him there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he you know, I can't remember his last name. He was with Deshimaru in Europe, and he married a rather wealthy woman, and He bought a building somewhere downtown. He took me there when they had just got it. They were remodeling it and started a Zen center there. Right. Is it living?
Huh.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I just connected with him because I have so many Dharma books. And I thought, well, there's a Zen center here. Maybe they have a library and I could donate a lot of these books, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, really good Buddhist books. So, John, you know, we texted and stuff, and he said, that's great, you know, and he came over, and we really hit it off. He's a really nice guy. And his wife, they do a lot of social stuff, social justice stuff. They're really good. And, you know, we've become good friends there. So when I go back there, I'm going to connect with the Zen practice. He said he would like me to give a little talk about what it was like to be around Roshi, which is probably about the, I'd say about the same way I just said to you, because, you know, I wasn't anybody special to, in any way there, you know, but I do have, everybody has, we all have our own, how he affected us and
yeah.
How powerful that was and helpful and so forth. So
yeah,
I'll probably do that when I go back there. We're living there about 5 or 6 months of the year and about 5 or 6 or 7 here.
Yeah.
Like that.
Robert's name, I remembered his full name, Robert Livingston. I just found it. There's a Wikipedia page for him.
Oh.
He died this year, January 2nd.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. He was born in 33. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was a character. He was a character.
Probably about 74 or 75, right? Somewhere around there.
Pardon? Oh, me? I'm 76.
Yeah, I figured that. I knew I was older than you.
Yeah. I'll be 77 in February.
I'll be 81 in April.
Huh. Oh, right. On my son's birthday, April 19th.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. You know, I'm going to tell my son Kelly, because every now and then, you know, he still has some idea that, well, Kelly's mostly a girl's name.
That's right.
You know? And I said, look, you know, he used to be a quarterback for Seattle named Kelly Stouffer. You know, we joke around. He doesn't really mind. But I'm going to tell him I met another old friend whose son's named Kelly, too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And my father was Kelly, although he was Kelroy. See, and he didn't like Kelroy. So everybody called him Kelly.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was very fond of my father. And I'm also fond of my son, Kelly. Yeah.
I would hope you are.
Yeah. It is definitely a name that has more females than males with that name.
But yeah, I'm Irish and I like the name, you know.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I guess we should call it a day. Look, it's been great talking with you. And say hello to Ken for me. Tell him I want to talk to him, all right?
I will do that, David. I will text you his number.
Information
to connect with him. Yeah, because I had mentioned to him yesterday. We played ping pong. We played ping pong over the Y with this group that plays ping pong. You know, and although it's a little harder playing with masks on now, but Ken, I mentioned to Ken. You know, or actually, I was over his house the day after on watching football. The Broncos, and I think I mentioned that I was, you know, that we've been in contact and we were going to do that. And he was really interested. We kind of talked a little bit about, yeah, the last time we saw you was over at Shipping's house and stuff. So, you know, that would, he kind of knows what you're doing and, you know, it wouldn't be strange at all for you to be contacting.
Oh, good, good. You know, when I saw you back then, and you and Ken and, I wanted to talk to you about doing an interview back then, but I didn't want to, I was enjoying just visiting with you, and I just didn't want to bring it up. I remember that.
Yeah, I think we might, I don't remember, both of us owned houses down there for a while, and my wife and I sold ours about 5 years ago, but Ken and his wife still have one, and she and I stay there. We go there every few months or so and spend the weekend in Ken's place, but I think, I'm not sure if we were there for a practice thing, you know, because sometimes it was just to be down there, and sometimes it was practice in those days, but well, I certainly remember.
Yeah, Shippy set it up. I'm sure I always see Shippy when I go there.
Yeah, Shippy's lived there forever.
Yeah, you can walk down to his place from Creststone Mountain Zen Center, Dick Baker's place. And he's like 85. He's 85. He's doing really well, actually.
Shippy?
No, Dick Baker. Shippy's doing good, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, Rich, I became friends with Richard because both of us, my oldest son is 60. My youngest son is 22. And the 22 and I, we lived in Crestone for about a year. My wife and I tried it when I retired for her coming down on the weekends and then for long periods. And because we were considering moving down there, you know, but we still needed to make money. She still would work. And Richard's son, his daughter and my son were in the same school there, you know, in Crestone.
Oh, yeah.
So we became kind of friends, and then up in Boulder, I went to one of his weekend things because I was doing a little bit of hospice-like stuff and with one of his students who went there. And he actually asked me to give a talk on Vajrayana the last day, and I was which was really surprising. He was really leaning out from the Zen thing somewhat, and we really had a nice connection. And I was going to, and then the person I was with kind of had a breakdown and I had to leave with them, so I couldn't do it. But we really had a kind of nice connection again, which I was super glad with, because we didn't at Zen Center. It wasn't bad, but it was just,
yeah,
we didn't, and it was nice to become friends after all those years.
Yeah,
you know, and,
well, he's different now than he was back then.
He's really different now.
Yeah,
I mean, he's,
you know,
and his teaching was really good. It really had a lot of space to it. It wasn't holding on to any one thing either.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now he's a very creative person.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
I mean, he got his trouble, but everybody does.
Yeah. He,
of course, I've never done anything wrong along the lines, but
he didn't let it slow him down. Well, it did slow him down. I mean, it was a train wreck, but he kept going. And
he did.
Yeah, I there was this psychic I used to see a lot. Oh, I met him same year I met Suzuki, and he lived to be in his 90s, and I could just ask him about people, anybody I knew, and he'd just start telling me about them. And I said, hey, what, and I wouldn't, you wouldn't know who he was talking about, right? I said, what do you think about Richard? And he said, there's a guy that can be knocked down 3 times and still get up. And Fred was used to be a wrestler, and he was a pretty tough guy, wrestler and a boxer. He said, most guys can't get up 3 times. He said, but he can. I thought that was an interesting comment. It was, you know.
That is very much, because that's very kind of what he did, really.
Yeah.
He can, you know, funny, the teachings I told you about with my teacher in Crestone, the big tent that he does for 2 weeks every year.
Yeah.
For the last 8 years, Richard came to one of those.
Did he? Wow.
Yes, he did.
Really?
Not the whole, thing, but Sonny Rinpoche kind of recognized him and had some very humorous and nice interactions with him. You know, during the talk, he blended it in. So it was very, very nice. You know, Pema Chodron comes to those sometimes. She's there. I don't think she was there at the one that Baker Roshi was at. And Baker Roshi's main monk, Christian, I think, came now and then, too. So, you know, Crestone in particular, you felt the atmosphere, but there was a lot less sectarianism there than there was in a lot of things, you know. There was just such a, you know, so many different solid spiritual traditions, and Richard Baker's being one of them, you know, and they really, you know, interacted with each other a lot more than most places, really. Crestone, you know, the Indian, Crestone was a place the Indians went when they were fighting and stuff, and no one fought in Crestone. That was where they would go to make their, try to make their peace with each other.
Oh, really?
So somehow that, yeah, it's had that atmosphere, that aura for a long, long time.
Tassajara had various Indian tribes coming there and being at peace with each other. I mean, I have read that. There's not a great deal known about all that history, but that's what I read.
I bet that's true. I mean, there's a certain peacefulness to Tassajara that was unique, too, in a certain way.
Yeah. Well, it was known to Indians over, you know, 1,000 miles away.
Wow, I'm not surprised at all.
I think that far. I know up in Oregon, I've read. I never remember this coming up, but I knew when I lived at Tassajara that an American Indian can go to a hot springs for free. I remember that.
Is that right?
At least I had that idea. You know, it turns out so many things you think are true turn out not to be. But
like Santa Claus. I still want to believe Santa Claus.
Right. Okay. Well, look, good talking with you. And until we meet again, take care.
Yeah, and take care of Kelly and Clay.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.